always had a sort of sneaking suspicion that Republicans tend to make the best political ads. They seem to be sharper and more pointed in many instances versus the Democratic ads that you see. Maybe that's just sort of a hazy prejudice on my part or something, but boy, there have been some killer GOP ads over the years. And so these folks are dyed-in-the-wool Republicans, many of them. Steve Schmidt, I know, is very involved in the Lincoln Project. He, of course, is former campaign manager for John McCain when McCain ran for president. And other leading Republican names are involved in this project. And so we're going to be talking about this new ad up involving a Vermonter ER doc at the University of Vermont Medical Center by the name of Dan Barkoff. And then later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Patty McCoy. She's the Republican leader in the Vermont House. So get the GOP take on where things are going in the legislature. And another chapter of our discussion of Act 250, the longtime Vermont land use planning law, in the second hour of the program today. We have a couple of folks coming by to put another coat of paint on that very complicated but important topic here. And but let's start right in this morning with Dr. Dan Barkoff. I'm glad I was able to catch you when you're not on duty there at the ER, and I thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, Dave, no problem. Happy to be here. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay, and although I understand when you're not on duty at the ER, you are on duty providing oversight over a couple small children. Is that right?
There's a couple small children. There's some Peppa Pig that might play in the background, but I think we should be okay for a short period here.
Okay, great. Well, so this ad that you, made, I'm going to see if my producer Dana Jewell has found it on YouTube, and maybe you can play some. Do we have it there, Dana? Let's hear some of this commercial that in which Dr. Dan Barkoff is the star. Here he is.
My name is Dan Barkoff. I'm a 2001 United States Naval Academy graduate. I'm an ex-Navy SEAL, currently an emergency room physician, and the founder of Veterans for Responsible Leadership. Months ago, Donald Trump learned that the Russians were paying bounties for dead American soldiers in Afghanistan. He chose to do nothing about it. Any commander-in-chief with a spine would be stomping the living shit out of some Russians right now, diplomatically, economically, or, if necessary, with the sort of asymmetric warfare they're using to send our kids home in body bags. Mr. Trump, you're either a coward who can't stand up to an ex-KGB goon, or you're complicit. Which is it? Donald Trump is unfit to be our commander-in-chief, and that's worse than useless. I'm a pro-life, gun-owning combat veteran, and I can see Trump for what he is, a coward. We need to send this draft dodger back to his golf courses. The lives of our troops depend on it.
Wow, you are not mincing words there, Dr. Dan. And I'm curious to know sort of how you got connected with the Lincoln Project. What was the genesis of this?
Yeah, happy to. So, you know, it's all Vermont connections, to be honest with you. So the big thing for Veterans for Responsible Leadership, you know, kind of a formative moment for us, was getting hooked up with Stuart Stevens. He's a GOP, or was a GOP strategist. He's since left the party, but he worked closely with George Bush and John McCain on several of their campaigns, and most recently Mitt Romney. And Stuart is a Stowe resident, and I was in Marco's Pizza in South Burlington, this was 3 years ago, and read an article about Stuart in 7 days, and I was like, I got to get in touch with this guy. So reached out, and you know, we talked about the current administration and what we're trying to do, and since then it's been a fairly fruitful partnership. I mean, Stuart, you know, kind of knows all those guys, and I was fortunate enough to you know, to develop a working relationship with Stuart, and really he's the connection to, you know, Lincoln Project.
I see. Okay. And where was this ad made? Did you film it at your home, or where are you in the commercial?
We're physically in Stuart's kitchen. That is Stuart's kitchen. And yeah, we just got a local Stowe photographer and, you know, set it up, and took an hour you know, shot kind of the raw footage, and then, you know, the Lincoln Project edited it and added various things to it.
Yeah. And have you had, you know, much sort of follow-up media exposure, any other interviews and so on? And how's that gone?
Yeah, so, you know, I've had a couple of requests, a couple that I've turned down just, you know, schedule-wise. It was kind of a crazy week. I was actually doing a little bit of, you know, work at my job, my real job. And and then I am going to be on a Skype interview tomorrow with MSNBC tomorrow morning.
I see. Okay. And it's and in fact, I saw them. I think I saw them or one of the other networks play a clip of your ad, just a short piece yesterday or the day before. So this is definitely garnering some attention here. And what do you think about my theory that that the Republicans have some talented ad makers in their ranks? Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm kind of amazed by, you know, how they've, the Lincoln Project has just been able to roll out these, you know, these hits keep on coming. And, you know, I think it's resonating because I think it's true. You know, they've yet to do an ad, and I've, you know, had many meetings with those guys, and I don't think they've done anything untruthful. I mean, you know, they're attacking Donald Trump for factual things that he has done in his administration. And, you know, I think that's why it's gaining traction. And, you know, there are still swing voters in this election that we're trying to convince. You know, I think the piece that I did, you know, I think it's important to point out that this guy does not have the support of, you know, everyone who's ever served. And, you know, the way he lives his life, the way he leads as a president is really, you know, in my opinion, unethical, and, you know, completely at odds with the style of leadership that we learn at places like the Naval Academy and ROTC and boot camp. You know, there's no job whatsoever that Donald Trump can do in the military. You know, there, I'd even go so far as to say there's very few jobs that Donald Trump could actually do. You know, if he was flipping burgers at McDonald's and he acted the way he acts, he would be fired. You know, if he was a fire team leader in the Army, he would be fired. If he was a general, he would be fired. You know, there is nothing that this guy can do. He is a con man.
It's interesting that, I mean, basically, one of the reasons he gets away with the behavior that is alleged about him and which is proven about him in some instances is that he's president. There's basically nobody who can fire him. Is that right?
Well, I mean, you know, Congress tried to fire him, but yeah, I mean, exactly. You know, so it's you know, my take on Trump and to an extent Trumpism. You know, I think it's largely transactional. You know, people are all in on Trump, and I think there's going to be some very quick selective amnesia, and hopefully in about 6 months when you know, he loses this election, and you know, people are, you know, going to kind of go back and recall what they did for the last 4 years. And I'm anticipating some chaos in the Republican Party with people trying to backpedal over how much they actually supported this guy.
You know, it's interesting to me that one of the themes that really popped out just the other evening, I thought, people oftentimes criticize this president for being a little self-centered, of really focusing on the impacts of whatever is going on kind of his own image and his own standing in the polls and his own political future, et cetera, et cetera. He made these remarks to Fox Business in which he was talking about finally coming around and warming up a little bit to the idea of wearing a mask to avoid the spread of the COVID-19 virus. And he said that, you know, one of the things he had discovered wearing a mask was that he didn't think he looked too bad in it, that it made him look a little bit like the Lone Ranger. I don't know if you caught those comments,
right?
But to me, that just was a crystallized form. People tell me he was trying to be funny, and maybe that was part of it. But even if he's joking, his jokes go to, you know, how I look, basically.
Right.
He's
the most vain and pompous. You know, I'm writing a piece right now for the Bulwark, and I kind of flipping through my file of, you know, Donald Trump quotes that I can't believe. You know, one was that he was supposed to be drafted as a Major League Baseball player, but decided to go into real estate, you know, and he documented, like, hit 188 in high school in New York, You know, it's laughable, but his self-image, and you know, it would be hilarious if he wasn't the president of the United States. But you know, I'm in complete agreement. I mean, he's so image conscious. You know, he found his niche as a reality TV star where people actually care about that stuff. But you know, your average American who's concerned about substantive government, I don't see how they can continue to support this man.
Well, let's talk about the substantive stuff here for a moment, because we are somewhat concerned about that on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV, FM, and AM. And I do want to just get into the allegation here is incredibly serious, that the Russian government has been paying members of the Taliban and affiliated groups in Afghanistan to basically to kill U.S. troops who are there. And and I saw one report the other day that you can get paid up to $100,000 for a successful assassination of a U.S. Military person. And the allegation is that the president learned about this in February or March, and that he hasn't done anything about it. Are you aware of or ever seen anything? I mean, you're a military person yourself, a Navy SEAL veteran, and someone who obviously is very familiar with the conduct of foreign policy. And I'm wondering, have you ever seen or heard anything like this before in terms of the United States being the target here and then not doing anything?
Yeah, so short answer is not really. You know, I don't recall any circumstance where I ever heard anything about that. And, you know, I certainly couldn't comment on any, you know, it's been 10 years since I was in the military, but, you know, I certainly can't comment on anything that remains classified. But, I mean, historically, there are certain instances of, you know, even individual U.S. troops being targeted. You know, the Jake Tapper's book, The Outpost, you know, they talk specifically about an Army captain who was essentially individually targeted in the Coronel Valley. And, you know, it's not unheard of. What's unheard of is for another great power to sort of be actively, you know, paying for this. You know, it's the kind of thing that I would expect from, you know, our true enemy. You know, if Al-Qaeda was paying bounties on U.S. troops, so, okay, I get that. I understand how that's, you know, but, you know, for the Russians to be doing it, and, you know, when we're not in a hot war, or, you know, supposedly not even in a cold war with them anymore, I think that demands an appropriate response. And I think that, you know, one can argue what the details of that response should be. You know, should it be diplomatic? Should it be economic? Should it be, you know, some sort of covert action? You know, those are all decisions for policymakers, but you know, the fact is Trump's made none of those decisions. He's essentially ignored it, and when he hears information that he doesn't like, he calls it fake news and hopes it goes away. And you know, how can you have that as a leader? Again, back to my original point, you know, if you were you know, if it was your son or daughter's little league coach who acted this way, you'd pull him right off the team, and this guy's the president of the U.S.
Yeah, I wonder the, you know, in the case of the troops in Afghanistan, this has got to be very disheartening for the military and kind of morale and that kind of stuff. How do you get up every morning and go to work as one of the U.S. troops in Afghanistan, or really anywhere else in the world, if you don't have the sense that your commander in chief has your back?
Sure, I mean, you know, I want to put, you know, of course I do not speak for all people in the military. I speak for Dan Barkas, right? But I'll tell you my opinion. And my opinion is that, you know, when you join the military, when I was 18 years old and I joined the military, that right there is making your decision, right? You swear the oath, you're going to obey the Constitution, you're going to obey lawful orders from your commander in chief. And then, you know, things just sort of happen. You know, it seemed like one minute I was 18 and, you know, taking an oath, and the next minute I was on a foot patrol in Fallujah. You know, so, you know, when you're there, I didn't pay very much attention to politics back home. You know, I think some of the, you know, the the palace intrigue and the domestic politics gets lost, it's sort of irrelevant, right? Like, you know, people in the Taliban want to kill you regardless of whether they get money to do it or not. So your job there is to do your job and look out for your fellow soldiers or Marines or whoever it is. And, I don't think, on a day-to-day basis, people are probably thinking about, what's going on back home, but that doesn't excuse the president's behavior. He basically decided that they're pawns and he doesn't care about them. And, whatever Putin wants, he's either cowed by the man or, there's something else that we don't know about yet. But, I think people in the military are professional enough to do their job and understand the risks regardless of, something like this.
Really, it's troubling. It's fascinating. It is, I think, an important conversation that we're having here. My guest is Dr. Dan Barkoff. He is an emergency room physician at the University of Vermont Medical Center in Burlington, and he is also, I guess, the star, if that's the proper term, of a new ad, or an ad that's been out close to a week now, I think, or so, from a group called the Lincoln Project. The Lincoln Project is a group of current, I guess, and former Republican Party members and operatives and activists, et cetera, who have put together a bit of a campaign. I guess, is the aim, from your understanding, Dan Barkoff, to defeat Donald Trump? And I guess that would mean electing Joe Biden most likely this fall. I can't imagine that a lot of the conservative Republicans in the group are all that excited about that prospect, but it sounds like a real, a lesser of two evils kind of situation right now, or how would you read that?
So that's the wrong way to look at it, David. So, what I think is, under ordinary circumstances, would, people, these kind of center-right Republicans, would they be voting for, myself included, would we be voting for Joe Biden? No. These are not ordinary circumstances. Joe Biden clearly a man who will do a much better job than Donald Trump. That doesn't matter.
Excuse me, I'm not sure what you did with your phone, but you're getting a little muffled now. I don't know if we can get back into your previous.
Sorry about that. I think Joe Biden is clearly the superior choice in this election. Joe Biden is going to abide by the Constitution. Joe Biden is a person who, while all politicians, are somewhat flexible with the truth, I think Joe Biden will not tell dozens of lies every day. Joe Biden will respond if there are threats made from foreign powers against our troops. I don't know if you heard this part, but, under ordinary circumstances, an ordinary election, I'd vote for an ordinary Republican. A Mitt Romney, I'd be happy to vote for in this election. This is not ordinary times, and Donald Trump needs to go. And if that means Joe Biden's the president, terrific. I'm on board.
I had an interesting conversation not long ago with a relative, actually, who is, I guess I could say, an evangelical Christian, and someone I was sort of talking to him about, I had some questions about really to what degree Trump and some of his policies are in keeping with the gospel, right? The New Testament, you look at his immigration policy on the one hand, you look on the other hand at the famous line, I was a stranger and you took me in, from the Bible. In situation after situation, not only in policy, but in personal behavior, Trump just doesn't seem like somebody I would think of, first off, as a very devout Christian, and yet he has incredibly solid support among evangelicals. And my relative responded to these questions by saying one word: abortion. And I know that the president opposes abortion, and I heard you in the Lincoln Project ad say that you are pro-life. I guess that is the key that makes him attractive to some evangelicals and some conservative Catholics. It doesn't cut it with you, it sounds like.
So my views on on that issue are are complicated. I'm a citizen of this democracy first and foremost. Mm-hmm. Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. I respect that. Not everyone has to agree with me. I think the pro-life movement would be very well served by stop trying to focus on winning unwinnable court cases and trying to address the problems like access to birth control and supports for new mothers that boost the levels of folks who seek abortions. I think we should have free and immediately accessible birth control for anyone who wants it. Now, all that being said, Trump gets a pass for his personal behavior because, exactly what you said, evangelicals will bring out that particular issue. And, part of the reason I made that ad, part of the reason I said, I'm pro-life, and I'm not a guy who protests outside clinics or anything. I have a nuanced view of the subject. And I'm willing to partner with people who are pro-choice. I think there is room for compromise on that issue. I say that on an ad that's being released to the public because, someone has to go first, Dave, right? Someone has to say the emperor has no clothes on. And, I think it's effective if that comes from someone who ought to be a Republican, right? Like, I ought to be a Republican, but I am not, and I will never be a Republican as long as Donald Trump is associated with the party in any way. And I encourage other people who might be more conservative, to think about other options. And, this is about Trump, Trump, and Trump.
Yeah, it really is. It is almost a cult of personality, I think, at times, which, I don't understand the particular attractiveness of this personality. That's one of the weird things about this is that with as many personal foibles as this guy has, and maybe that's part of the attractiveness. People feel like if their leader can do certain things, maybe they have a license to do things that they might have had some reticence about previously. I go back to the mask issue. What do you think, as a medical person, what do you think of this sense that seems to be at large in the country right now that, it used to be there were signs on storefronts occasionally that said no shirt, no shoes, no service, right? And, I grew up seeing these as a kid and as a young adult, and it never occurred to me ever to think of those in the context of politics or whether I support the current president or don't support the current president. But now this other thing that people are being asked to wear seems to have all this political baggage connected to it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I bet you can guess pretty clearly what my stance is on mask wearing. First of all, I'm not a public health guy, but I do believe in expert knowledge, and I will listen to the public health people. And yeah, it's crazy that this has become a political issue. And I think, unfortunately, you're seeing you're about to see some of the consequences of that over the southern part of our country. Vermont's been very fortunate so far. I hope that Vermonters continue to listen to the experts on this issue, and we can hopefully keep this this pandemic from literally killing thousands of Vermonters, which it could do at any time if we're not careful about it. And I agree. The best argument, this goes to the evangelicals as well, but the best argument, the argument that people gave for Trump was, the world is a scary place and this guy's going to keep us safe. I never agreed with that argument, but that's what people said. And, people who voted for him, and he's demonstrably failed at that. We are not safer with Trump as the president. We're nowhere near safer. We have 130,000 dead Americans with no end in sight. We have a Russian bounty scandal on our troops. This guy is not keeping us safe from anything. He's made us much less safe. So if you're voting on a security issue, you know, clearly he's the worst choice.
Dan Barkoff, Dr. Dan Barkoff, I should say, emergency room doctor at the University of Vermont Medical Center and star of this recent Lincoln Project ad. You can look it up on YouTube. Just type in Betrayed, and Dan Barkoff, I think, will be a search that will bring it up. I thank you very much for joining me this morning. We're about out of time, but I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Happy to do it, Dave. Take care.
All righty. Take care. Hey, we're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and back. We're going to be talking with Patty McCoy, the Republican leader of the Vermont House, in the second half hour. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and we were scheduled to speak with Patty McCoy, the Republican leader in the Vermont House, in the second half hour of today's program, and we're having trouble tracking her down. So if Patty McCoy is out there and listening and would like to check in with us, 244-1777. Is the number for the Waterbury, the local number in Waterbury, the toll-free number where she might call from her home down there in southern Vermont, 877-291-8255. There we go, 291-8255 in the 877 area code. So, it sounds like we now have achieved contact with Representative McCoy, and Patty McCoy will be my guest for the next little while here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And Representative McCoy, thank you very much for joining us.
No, you're quite welcome. Sorry about that.
That's quite all right. we were just issuing some regrets here, but I'm very glad to call off the regrets and say instead,
I never didn't ring. I don't know what happened. So.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, you know, it's communications, especially here in the state of Vermont, where we have much chatter from time to time about getting better cell service and better broadband, et cetera.
Right.
But yeah, anyway. So I wanted to bring you on the program to talk with you and kind of get a summary from you about kind of where we are from the perspective of the Republican minority in the Vermont House. How this session has gone. It's been a weird session, obviously, with the remote meetings and the concern about the COVID-19 virus and all this sort of thing. Tell me what, if you had to say, if a constituent came up to you on the street and said, "So, Patty, you're our local state rep here. What's the headline for this session so far, the 2020 session of the Vermont State Legislature?"
Well, it's certainly historic. I don't recall ever, somebody had mentioned once back in the 1800s, evidently when the state house burned, legislature had to meet remotely, but their meeting remotely meant like they're going next door to a building and still meeting in person. So this remote voting is certainly a different way of attempting to do legislative business, not very easily. I hope we don't have to do it again. Evidently, we're coming back in August and, talking about maybe possibly a hybrid where some are in the state house, depending on where we are with the COVID virus, understanding completely that there was no way we could meet face-to-face. But this was definitely a difficult session to try to follow and even on remote sessions, people would lose, as you said, our IT in the state is, we don't have broadband in a lot of places. People were dropping the calls and having to come back on or not have their video on because the audio would not the bandwidth would not support both audio and video. So it was difficult. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now some folks are say that when those technologies worked, in those instances that they did, they actually expanded public access because anybody could tune in from anywhere without trying to drive to Montpelier and find a non-existent parking spot. And the flip side of that, I guess, has been that with these technical glitches and with the just ongoing difficulty with our absence of broadband in some parts of the state, that the folks who were not able to make that connection were pretty much excluded from participation. Would you say that the opportunities for public participation since the legislature went kind of electronic back there in mid-March and the period up to now, or the last week, I should say, would you say that the public access to deliberations of legislature improved or got worse?
Well, we've always had our the House floor, I believe it's Vermont Public Radio, actually broadcasts that to anybody who wants to listen to that deliberation, which is the same as when we're on YouTube, I guess, is what they do. But the public access is pretty much non-existent when we're in committee rooms. You might be able to watch us on YouTube, but it's not the same as having the person sitting in your committee room with you and us being able to call on them if we have a question on something. That was non-existent this session, you know, from March 13th on. So that's a huge loss for us to try to figure out, you know, so how does this work or what do you do? And, you know, you have a lot of public interest groups that are, you know, nonprofits that are, you know, hankering for money and or telling us why they needed the money, and we didn't have that unless we specifically had a specific time for it and remembered to call and say, okay, that you can dial in at this particular time and we can listen to you for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. Because we had, we ourselves in committee had limited time. Not all committees could meet every single day because of the broadband issue. IT just could not handle having every 14 committees in the House, and what, are there 14 or 12 in the Senate? So it just could not handle them. So I'm on transportation. We had limited amount of time, like Tuesday for an hour and a half, Wednesday for, you know, an hour and a half, and Thursday for an hour or something. So it's not the same as being there every day for, you know, 8-9 hours a day in your committee room.
So. Yeah, that is for sure. And I know it's been frustrating for legislators, for lobbyists, for, you know, for members of the public. There's a whole sort of cadre of folks who kind of hang around the State House. They aren't really paid lobbyists. They're sort of, I don't know exactly how they support themselves in some cases, but they are sort of just freebooter gadflies who like to be participants in the debates and stuff and pigeonhole or buttonhole legislators in the hallways and try to raise issues that they think are important. Those folks especially seem to be quite frustrated. I've talked to a few of them in the in recent weeks, and you know, a lot of people complaining about not making it onto the list of people invited to testify electronically and so on and so forth. So I'd say it's been a pretty bumpy ride for sure.
Yeah, it has been. And you know, the other issue is our legislative council, which, I mean, there was, you know, you could just walk down to legislative council and ask them a question. Okay, so I'm thinking of doing this, or, you know, how do I handle this? Or if I draft legislation, or there is this legislation, can you explain it to me? I mean, that's completely lost, that face-to-face with ledge council, which is huge for the legislature who depends on them to explain the law or the proposed law, you know, what you want to see happen and what is happening, or what that draft legislation that we're going to be dealing with on, you know, tomorrow actually mean. Yep. So
yep.
It's frustrating at times, yeah.
For those who aren't familiar, Legislative Council is kind of an amazing organization, I've always thought. Basically, it's a team of lawyers, young and very hardworking, especially during the legislative session. They put in long, long hours, and in the weeks leading up to the start of the legislative session, when a lot of folks are filing or are looking to file bills and so on, because these are the people who actually draft the legislation. They do a lot of research to figure out what other states are doing in various areas that are going to be subject of legislation. They do a whole ton of research into Vermont's own laws to make sure that a new idea for a law doesn't conflict with what's already on the books. And I mean, there's just a lot to it. And it's always been kind of frustrating for me as a journalist and as a radio host, because I've felt from time to time it'd be really cool to kind of feature some of these folks and kind of, you know, talk about their lives and what they contribute to the process. It's a very nonpartisan outfit. I mean, that's one amazing thing, is that in a lot of right. state legislatures, you know, individual parties and even party memberships of committees have their own staffs and so on and so forth. That's certainly the case in the Congress. Here you have these folks who are really have to play it down the middle. I mean, it's not a big organization, and so they have to serve everybody in terms of the different parties. And I just, my hat's off to them, and I wish I could do more about sort of featuring who they are and what they do. They're also right. very, very reticent about any press coverage. They don't like it.
Yeah.
they're like, we want to stay in the background. That's our role. And we yeah. insist on staying in the background, and that's the end of the story. So there
yeah.
you go.
Yeah, they do a great job. They really do. Yeah, we really depend heavily on them. Yep.
Yeah, and I wonder also, And it's interesting to hear you say that, Patty, because right now you're the Republican leader in the House. The Republicans have how many members in the House do you have? It's less than 50, right?
43. Yes, 43.
43. And you would think if there were any tint of sort of, you know, partisan leaning or anything like that from the Legislative Council, that it might show up more readily in a time when, you know, one of the major parties has a fairly diminished caucus, right? That would sort of be human nature, but they really resist that to the extent that the Republican leader can come on the radio and talk about how they do a great job. So I think that's yes. a credit to them.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yep. Hey, let's talk about some of the actual legislation that you guys are working on. You have this process here that I guess really was devised mainly by the Democratic majority in the House and Senate to create this budget going the first 3 months of fiscal 21, which of course started Wednesday, I think it was, and then to return in August and try to when our fiscal analysts, our economists try to figure out what the heck the state's economy is going to look like over the next couple of years. And craft the budget very shortly thereafter for the remainder of the fiscal year. That overall strategy, which is the first time in my memory it's ever been tried to sort of split the fiscal year into sections like that. What do you think of that? Did you agree with that? Did you think it was a good way to go, or is it just a matter of the Democrats decided that they have the majority, so here we go?
It would have been difficult to try to figure out the entire FY21 budget, because the economic forecast wasn't even going to come out until August 14th or 15th of this year. And, you know, they had talked about, you know, $400 million deficit, and I think it's down a little bit from that. But, you know, nobody really knows what our economic forecast will be, even in August when they give it to us. I mean, I always think they're best guess estimates anyway. I mean, that's what they're trying to figure out. So I think the quarter one budget to do that was a wise decision. However, I have to give hats off to the House appropriations as well as Senate, but, you know, the money bills start in the House, and mm-hmm. our House Appropriations Committee did a yeoman's job to try to get, you know, a 3-month budget out and in a short amount of time, because they had pretty much done the budget for FY22 when we left March 13th. They were ready to bring that to the floor the following week. So for them to just, like, throw that out the window and start again for 3 months, and then having knowing that they're coming back in August to finish it another 9 months, I mean, I just hats off to House Approach, which, you know, you talk about the parties being working together. I mean, I think that committee, more so than any, really does try to set their, you know, D's and P's and R's at the door and walk in there and try to do, you know, what's best for Vermonters when they're in that room to try to deliberate. And they're hard decisions that they have to make. Not that they always agree, but, you know, they try to come to a consensus that, you know, you can live with on things. You know, I've been told that if a bill comes to the floor and not everybody's happy with it, not either side can say that they won, then that's a good bill. And, you know, I think sometimes that's how the Appropriations Committee does their work. And I think they do a good job on it. And, you know, I have to hats off to Representative Toll, who is not going to be with us. She's decided not to run again, but she really is, you know, they all are pretty much fiscally constrained, I'll say, not conservative, but they are fiscally constrained when they are in that room, because they know, you know, there's just so much money to go around, and, you know, they make the hard decisions on where that money goes. So they came up with a budget, a quarter one budget, that I think was a, you know, pretty reasonable one. Not everybody was happy with what came out, but it was something that people could live with, and knowing that they have to come back in August and do it again. I mean, so this is like really three budgets they've done.
Amazing.
9 months. It really is amazing. It is.
It's usually amazing when you think about the work that goes into crafting the budget every year in a normal year. I've sometimes thought that was amazing, but this is three times amazing. Whatever that is. Yikes! Holy cow! And Patty, I'm blanking on your hometown. Where's your district, and where do you live?
I live in Pulteney, Vermont, Rutland County, and I serve the towns of Pulteney and Ira.
Okay. Couldn't remember whether it was Pulteney or someone or the other. I knew it was Western Rutland County, but I just was having trouble putting the needle exactly in the right place on the map. So there you go. And you have actually have a neighboring House member, Bob Helm, who I think he's been on the Appropriations Committee for years now,
two from Rutland County, Bob Helm, Representative Helm, and Representative Peter Fagan from Rutland City.
I
mean, they do a great job. Yeah, they really do.
Yep.
And Linda Myers is also on there. So we have three Republicans sitting on that. Four.
Got it. Okay.
Marty Feltus is on there. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. It's a good crew. They work really, really hard, and they come up with consensus. I wanted to shift gears though for a couple of minutes and ask you, as a Republican leader in the House, and obviously somebody who talks to your caucus members a lot, and give us a sense of how they feel about Governor Phil Scott, another Republican, his handling of the coronavirus crisis and his response to it, and so on and so forth. What kind of reviews does he get among the members of the House Republican Caucus?
Governor Phil Scott, during this, I think he's done an excellent job, and I haven't heard anybody complain about from my caucus as well. Mm-hmm. I think everyone thinks he's done a phenomenal job. I mean, who would have thought, you know, when we started here in January, that this pandemic would have gripped not only our state but our nation and the world. I mean, it really has been quite incredible. And when you look at statistics from other states and how low our numbers are, you know, granted we're a smaller state, more rural, but really look next door to New Hampshire. You know, their numbers are much larger than ars. I think he says time and time again, you know, he looks at the science of it. Dr. Levine has done a great job. And opening slowly, we're opening slowly, which I think is the way to go. We think he's done a phenomenal job.
Well, that's interesting. I'll tell you, I do see some criticism online. It's always hard for me to read how that, you know, the chatter you get on Facebook and occasionally on Twitter kind of squares with the mainstream of you know, the various political trains of thought sort of more prominent in Vermont. I mean, I must say, I from the more liberal leaning people, I'm hearing the same thing, frankly. You know, some may disagree with Governor Scott on some, you know, his fiscal priorities in normal times and you know, other issues and that sort of thing. But boy, he is, from what I can gather from most quarters, he's getting very high marks. He and his team, you know, as you mentioned, Commissioner Levine, I think, has been a real steady, calming voice in this whole thing for to listen to over time. And the other folks in state government they all seem to be pulling in the same direction. There's not a lot of dissension. There's not a lot of uncertainty. I mean, everybody sort of knows, okay, here's the plan and let's get at it. I mean, so far I think the results are proof of good management to the extent you can manage this thing and
right.
respond in a responsible manner. So there's more hats off from another direction for right. Governor Phil Scott.
I mean, you're looking at other states now who are actually closing again. I mean, because they opened too early, and they, you know, so, you know, I just really think this measured approach was the right way to go.
Are you confident that the way things are actually playing out there on the ground comport pretty well with what is being requested and asked for by the governor and the other state leaders in Montpelier? And let me give you an example of what I'm thinking of. A couple weeks ago, we had a call on the show here from someone very concerned because they had been vacationing down in the sort of Rutland County Lakes region, right in your neck of the woods down there. I think they were at Lake Bomazene, and they saw a lot of folks coming over from New York State on the weekend. They were there who were not wearing masks and were not social distancing, and were sort of just partying up for a weekend of essentially vacationing at some lakeside cottage in Vermont. And so there was this concern that was voiced about for all the good intentions and the announcements we're getting, we are not necessarily following suit in every part of Vermont. Do you concur that that's a worry, or do you think that for the vast majority of cases that people are behaving themselves and comporting themselves in the way that's necessary in the light of the pandemic?
Well, I think for the most part people are, but, you know, bottom line is there's going to be people that are just not going to follow anything. I mean, they just don't think, they're just not going to do it. And, you know, wearing the masks, while it's not mandatory, I think the majority of people that I come in contact with, always, not that I go out a lot, but, you know, if I go to the grocery store, everybody has their masks.
All right. Well, hey, Patty McCoy, I hate to say this. I got to interrupt and tell you we're about out of time here, but I really appreciate you joining me this morning, Representative Patty McCoy, the Republican leader in the Vermont House. Thank you so much. Going to take a break for some top-of-the-hour news and a couple words from our sponsors. We'll be back with more of the Dave Grant.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us in into this second hour of our July 3rd program, 2020, Friday morning, the Independence Eve. Normally a big day, at least in the town where I live, Montpelier. We have a parade, we have fireworks, all that stuff. In a normal year, this year, not so much. Oh well. Hope folks are going to have some nice, quiet, homebound celebrations and cookouts and observances of our independence, United States birthday, of course, 4th of July. That's the big day every summer. And this year we have a little bit curtailed situation. I believe Bob Ney is on the line with us now, one of our national correspondents. Bob, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Happy pre-4th.
And you too. 4th Eve, maybe? I don't know exactly.
Yes, somewhere.
What's your top headline today?
Top headline is actually about, international, is about Hong Kong. And it's kind of interesting, Dave, because there are a certain amount of countries in the United Nations that are saying, hey, it's okay to crack down on Hong Kong. It's, you know, geared towards okay for China to do it. And a certain amount of countries that say it's not cool to do it. And the countries that are saying, yes, you can crack down, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, etc. But also some countries you may not expect. And that's because China has a lot of economic development projects, so they're afraid of, you know, obviously making China angry. Now, on the other side, European Union, most of them, the United Kingdom, of course, Britain, Australia, and others. Now, we aren't officially in the for or against category. We pulled out of the United Nations humanitarian rights group, and we did it because we were mad about some things they were passing concerning Israel. I've always kind of personally thought, Dave, that stay in a group if you don't like it to change it, but we didn't. But on another level, the Senate has just unanimously passed what the House sent over to sanction China in regards to what they're doing to Hong Kong. Now, one interesting twist I wanted to mention, the United Kingdom, Britain is saying to people in Hong Kong, because at one time it was British territory, if you would like to come and move to Britain, we're going to allow you to do that. That would include about 3 million some people that are living in Hong Kong. I thought that was fascinating.
Wow, that is pretty amazing.
We would never do that. So.
Well, there is that that consideration, but I wonder, are people taking them up on it, or is there a big migration now from Hong Kong to Britain?
Not yet, but I mean, I just did want to say, because I've been to Hong Kong several times, Hong Kong is a delightful place. It's not like you're living in a place where it's just so terrible. It's delightful. But, of course, because of the crackdown of the Chinese is making it a place that some people may not want to live. So there's not a great exodus now, but if the Chinese continue to do some of the things they're doing to Hong Kong, for example, if they deem you to be traitorous, they can put you in prison for life. If they continue to crack down, yeah, some people may obviously emigrate to England.
Well, yeah, we'll have to keep our eye on that. That could be mm-hmm. very interesting development, potential demographic impact to some extent on Great right. Britain also. And, you know, the world changes from time to time. And
it does.
Wow, fascinating. What about domestically or internationally, as international issues come back to bounce back domestically, shall we say? I'm thinking here, of course, of the this Russian bounties story and its possible impact politically in the United States. What are you seeing and hearing on that?
Well, there's a call, Dave, to investigate this, you know, by Senator Menendez from New Jersey of, you know, who knew what when and what was really happening. Does this bounty really happen? Senator Menendez sort of, I think, feels it does because he's talking about further, you know, sanctions on Russia. From the White House's end, it's been something I think they'd like to go away because it's, you know, who told whom what. And if it was discounted information that our, you know, National Security Agency or CIA felt, this is not really accurate, the outrageousness at least of the charge and the nature of the charge that Russians were paying to have our soldiers killed with a bounty, one would think they at least told the White House about it. Now, the president says he didn't know till he read about it, but you know, one would think they did. If they didn't, then I would assume they will get rid of the person that should have told the White House. But that is a big debate. Did the president know or not? And if he knew, what did he do about it or didn't do about it?
I guess the question
could have legs.
Yeah, and I guess the question also is, frankly, putting the most friendly take on this toward the president, let's say, for a moment, and taking him at his word that he didn't know about this before the media reports of last weekend. It's now been about a week. I don't think anybody would argue now that the president didn't know about it before, June 26th or 27th, mm-hmm. when this story first broke in the New York Times. And I'm wondering, at some point, somebody's going to have to ask the question, so what's he doing about it now that it is out and it's obvious he knows about it and et cetera?
Right. And you know, I understand there's flawed information. There, by the way, for your listeners, there's a movie called Taxi to the Dark Side, and it's by Alex Gibney. It's a documentary, eye-opening, about false information we were given in Afghanistan that led to the death of an innocent taxi driver. So do we have a history where we have some faulty information? Yes. We have a history where we have some accurate information. So, yeah, we can point to examples of either side, like I just did on Taxi to the Dark Side. But and I raise that issue because, you know, if you're president, you're going to say, look, is this a Taxi to the Dark Side type of information, or is this accurate? And tell me why it's accurate, or tell me why it's not. And so if that hasn't happened in the process, because you make a great point, Dave, you know, if he, let's say, hypothetically, he didn't know at one point in time, he knows now, and what do you do about it?
Yeah, yeah. I guess, weird roles being adopted here. Historically, Democrats have been leaning more toward trying to achieve some sort of a peace with Russia and with other adversaries over time. Here, the president is the one who's pretty much standing down from it, anything anybody could tell on this particular alleged offense by Russia. And it's some of his critics, including, you know, liberals and progressives and people who are normally, maybe I can't say they're all peaceniks, but they certainly include the peacenik end of military intervention debates and so on. Right. So I'm just, it's sort of a strange thing to hear this side that is also opposed to Trump in so many different ways coming out and basically saying he's got to be a lot tougher on Russia. Now, obviously, There's a range of things. There's economic sanctions. There are other diplomatic efforts that could be mounted. It doesn't all have to devolve immediately to some kind of military action. But there you go. It's kind of the weird shape of things today. Hey, Bob, I can't let you go without having some commentary from you about what the heck is going on with this coronavirus, the national surge out there. It's really, really, really just incredibly scary right now, isn't it?
Well, it is. Yeah, I mean, I know we have to look at the death rate. Worldwide, 500,000 people, it's 0.001. So it's not the 2% they predicted, but we, of course, are higher here in the United States, and I think we're doing more testing. So, yes, we would do more testing, and therefore we might have more cases, but I still think they have to also be very, very cautious about the two things. One, the death rate, and if the death rate is still low, there is still the amount of bed space that will be taken in intensive care units in hospitals. And when that happens, you don't have elective procedures, which are frankly pretty critical, pre-screening for cancer, you know, heart, cardio treatment, et cetera. So,
yep.
Again, I think it's something that it just can't be dismissed. Now, we can't go into complete, you know, panic and immediately shut everything down, but I think they've got to look at hot spots, death rates, the hospital's ability to take care of people, and then react, you know, to that. But they are talking about, like, for example, a national mask mandatory, type of executive order or something. I don't know whether President Trump would do that, but I think to just ignore it all would, you know, obviously not be good. They got to pay attention to surge and use sound science, obviously, instead of just, you know, what somebody else thinks in the political system.
Yeah, and in terms of the mask decision, I think it also probably is more important. The public health considerations are more important than how the president looks or whether he looks like the Lone Ranger.
Right.
Wouldn't you agree?
Exactly. Exactly.
I also, you're my age or a little older even, Bob, and I think you may recall that the mask worn by the Lone Ranger, which was around the eyes, would not really do much about the coronavirus. So,
well, that's just, true. And, you know, another thing, too, a few years back, if I wore a mask into one of the banks, I mean, I'd be kind of followed around. Now you can do it.
That's right. Oh, my word, how the world has changed. We can now put a cloth over our face when we go to do our banking.
Exactly.
Yikes. Okay. Well, don't go robbing any banks now this weekend, Bob,
just because you think
you might have a chance to wear a mask, you know.
Listen,
I appreciate you joining me. It's always good chatting with you. Let's do it again next week.
Too.
Have an excellent 4th of July. We are going to talk in the next few minutes here, or actually close to 45 minutes, about Act 250. It is Vermont's 50-year-old, or roughly thereabouts, land use development control law, and we had a session about it yesterday. Wanted to revisit it because right toward the end of the program, I got a call from a listener by the name of John from Callis, who started raising some really interesting issues and some history and cases, etc., about Act 250 in a way that I thought might shed some more light on what some of the current issues are before the legislature, as the legislature works to make changes to the law. This is a pending bill right now. It's in the Senate, and the House passed a version of it back before the COVID crisis started. I think the House bill passed in late February or thereabouts. And we have been watching this process unfold since then on via electronic means, as particularly the Senate Natural Resources Committee has been meeting to make changes to the House version and sort of come up with its own take on how to reform Act 250. We had the chair of that committee on, Christopher Bray, yesterday, as well as a couple of folks. Then when John called right near the end of the program, John from Callis, I said, boy, this guy's got some important things to say about Act 250. And we talked a little later. Turns out he is John Brabant. He is a longtime environmentalist and a former staff member, actually, at the Agency of Natural Resources. He has kindly decided he can come and join us as not just as a caller from the general public, but as a guest here on the Dave Graham Show today. So we're going to do that. And also, he recommended another person very knowledgeable about Act 250 from the perspective of an attorney who's been involved in a lot of Act 250 cases over the years, and that is Brooke Dingledean. She's based in Barrie, and she and John Brabant join us by phone this morning. And to the two of you, I welcome you to the Dave Graham Show, and thank you very much for giving us some time on this important issue, Brooke and John. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad to do it. Yeah, and John, I'm going to start with you because I wanted to pick up a thread of conversation that we began yesterday. You were talking about a major expansion of the Stowe Mountain Resort and the role of the town of Stowe in that, and then the role of the Act 250, the District 5 Environmental Commission. And by the way, Ed Stanek, the longtime administrator of that district, was one of our guests yesterday as well. And, John, I wanted you to kind of pick up this story about, I believe this was back during the 1990s, is that right?
Yeah, it was the mid-1990s during the Howard Dean administration, correct.
Okay, so Howard Dean is the governor, and Stowe Mountain Resort is looking to do a big building project up there. Tell us what happened.
So, the Dean administration was full tilt in support of the project, even to the point where they strongly advocated for the sale of what was then the state campground built by the CCC in the 1930s, and actually attempted to sell it for below the appraised value, and that's another story we won't get into today. But in the end, the legislature intervened and prevented that from happening in terms of the sale at under market value. Tied to this mega project that was to be built that is now in place was the need to upgrade the sewage plant in Stowe. Stowe has subdivision regs and zoning regs, which is a basis and would be a basis under this bill for exempting downtown development and designated developments such as this as exempt from Act 250 review. Stowe supported the project. They saw many benefits from having that located within their town. They needed to upgrade their sewage treatment plant to accommodate the increased what's called effluent sewage flow from the condominiums mm-hmm. and resort facilities. The Agency of Natural Resources staff were put under immense pressure to force through permits on a tighter timeline than is normal. When that didn't happen, according to Governor Dean's expedited schedule, I'm going to leave names out, a designee from the governor's office came down to the ANR and demanded that the required permits be issued without review, and staff complied. So a water quality certificate, which is necessary to conclude that it will not have an undue impact and that the project, the sewage plant project, would comply with not only state clean water standards, water quality standards, but also the Federal Clean Water Act. That declaration was made, even though it was actually the opposite. It would actually have negative impacts on the Little River. The certificate was issued. Now, the benefits of Act 250, this project fell under Act 250. If this law change passes, that's being pressed by VNRC and now the Senate Natural Resources Committee, and it looks like the full Senate, then that kind of project would be exempt. That sewage plant upgrade would be exempt. The wonderful outcome, and I call it wonderful because it truly was, of this Stowe case in point was that because of the Act 250 District 5 Commission having jurisdiction, they had formal hearings. Citizens that were felt aggrieved by this, people concerned about water quality, which I would think the NRC would be, and I know that back then they were, and they were on the same page as the folks engaged in this, they subpoenaed, and under threat of subpoena, ANR complied and put staff on the stand under oath, and the staff outed the Dean administration and made clear that the permit and water quality certificate that was issued did not pass muster, that it would actually impact the Little River and cause an expansion of what was then called the C-zone, and that was a zone of impact, resulting in a swimming area and a recreational area being off-limits to any water contact activity, swimming, canoeing, kayaking, fishing. The end result was Act 250 required A&R is supposed to be the steward of our water resources, to go back and require that that sewage plant be upgraded so as it would not have any deleterious impact from the increased effluent. And A&R, kicking and screaming, right, did that and required Stowe to put in this upgraded treatment system. I believe it was a filtration system and a ultraviolet treatment system, protecting the water quality of the and the public health and well-being of the user public. Without active
okay, let me stop you there for a moment, John, and just ask. So the upshot of this thing was that the project got its permit. The Stowe Resort was allowed to build pretty much what it wanted to, but the town was required to essentially make a more expensive and more environmentally friendly upgrade to its wastewater treatment system than might otherwise have been the case. Is that right?
That is correct. It cost Stowe a little bit more, which they could then mm-hmm. bill back to Stowe, the mountain company, They didn't want to build a mountain company that, by the way, at the time was owned by AIG, one of the wealthiest corporations in the world.
Yep.
And I will make a note, and I said it yesterday, the governor's first cousin was vice president of AIG Realty. And so there was so many conflicts of interest, it was not funny. And but for Act 250, it would have been a very different set of outcomes.
Let me ask Brooke Dingledean, our other guest here. I don't know if you remember that case, the Stowe case, if you were involved at all, but it sounds to me like a case in which Act 250 actually worked pretty well in terms of delivering outcomes that allowed economic development, but that also protected some key public interests here. Would you agree with that sort of description of events there?
Oh, I would agree with that. I think there are any number of anecdotal examples I can think of from my own career litigating for all different folks in Act 250, large developers, small developers, municipalities, as well as neighbors to projects.
Mm-hmm.
And the one takeaway that I have had from all of these situations, and I have seen various administrations strong-arm people within A&R, for example, to say to enter MOUs, which are called Memorandums of Understanding, which mm-hmm. says, we're not going to hold you to the standard, we'll compromise it, and everyone will agree to some kind of settlement on this particular issue or series of issues. So from my perspective, the most important thing about Act 250 is that it is a statute set up to strike a balance between the environment and economic development, and it does so in a way that honors the three co-equal branches of government that we have. And one of my grave concerns about the Act 250 bill that was pending before the House, which it took me two or three weeks to until I finally started screaming my head off, that I've been shut out of the process, and they would not let me come and testify when I felt I had some very relevant information to add. And so one of the most important things that I thought that House committee and our legislature needs to be reminded of is the basic civics lesson. And I hear some music playing, so I don't want to...
Yeah, Brooke, I want to get to this concern, but we're going to have to do so after the break. We need to go to some bottom-of-the-hour news from CBS and then a couple words from our sponsors, and we'll be back. And I want to hear this story from you in just a couple moments. We'll be back shortly, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow three people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us, folks. My guests are John Brabant, longtime environmentalist and former employee of the State Agency of Natural Resources. Also, attorney Brooke Dingledean, who is an attorney based in Barrie, and she is someone who's been very involved in a lot of Act 250 cases over time and has helped folks who are developers, large and small, and has helped neighbors who are concerned about a development. And so both sides of Act 250 cases, it sounds like. And Brooke, I want to apologize. We had to interrupt there. You were in the middle of a thought and had to go to a break, but I wanted to get back to the point you were trying to make. It sounds like you have a concern about maybe several concerns, but you were going to at least one of them about the legislation now pending in the Senate, passed the House earlier this year. Tell us what that was.
Sure. One of my biggest concerns here, and the scenario that John Brabant just described, the biggest issue with that is the administration being able to influence the people that have to make the decisions about whether or not an applicant passes the test on a certain thing, air pollution, wetlands, whatever it might be. And
mm-hmm.
and the influence that administration's policy or dictate has on the actual scientist or expert for ANR or anywhere else within the executive branch to make a decision. Now, how can we prevent that? How can we safeguard against any administration picking up the phone and saying, hey, this company is my friend or I want them to do well, change the standard for them. They have an easier test or give them a pass. We protect against that through our government that is three co-equal branches. It's set up in our Constitution, and it talks about the checks and balances of these three branches of government that we delegate different powers to. The most important thing, then, is when there's a regime like Act 250 or any permitting process that is controlled ultimately by policy of whoever's sitting in the governor's chair, that needs to be able to be looked at and examined and watchdogged by some other branch of government. The legislature grants them the power to do what they're supposed to do. The executive branch executes the law and is supposed to enforce it. And who checks on that? The judiciary. And our court system is essential to the Act 250 process, and every time that you delegate power to the executive branch to take rights away from Vermonters, to curtail what they can do with their property. And our Constitution in Vermont allows court redress of any harm. And this certainly is a harm because it is your rights in your property. There was a fellow that called in yesterday asking about regulatory takings. And the only place that anyone, an applicant or somebody opposed to a project, has to go to say, hey, what about this this pass that they got over at A&R? And do we know that the governor's office has picked up the phone and told A&R to do something? Of course we don't. But the only way to protect against that happening without any accountability and to ensure that the law is actually applied equally to everybody, not to one company because, oh, gee, they're getting some press for Vermont and we want to help them, but that is to go to the courts and to say to the environmental judge, what A&R did here in giving them a pass, they shouldn't have done that. They didn't meet the law, and now we want an independent judicial officer, law-trained judge, to look at that. Mm-hmm. That is essential to our freedoms, to our constitutional rights, and to the Vermont and the way of life in this country. Now,
would that disappear under the proposed legislation?
Well, it would have if the original bill had been enacted. The 2 or 3 weeks that I spent trying to testify before that committee, and then finally I was invited during the massive storm, the blizzard, so I made my way to Montpelier, and that was what it took to have some public process. I went to try to give our legislators a civics lesson because they were eliminating the environmental court. Everything was being reviewed by another layer within the administration, and that was the Natural Resources Board that gets appointed by the governor and takes their marching orders from the governor. So basically what the legislation did was say a permit's decided, and then we, the people who issued the permit, get to decide whether or not it complied with law, and you don't get to go talk with a judge anymore. I think it's unconstitutional. It violates our basic civics lesson, which is three co-equal branches, checks and balances. And it was eliminated.
But to your question, Dave, this bill would exempt downtown projects and designated residential neighborhoods, designated development areas, basically, from Act 250 review. And as Brooke said, there's a lot of pressure on the Natural Resources Board to influence outcomes in their area of jurisdiction. That being said, the hearings are on the record. They're quasi-judicial. Witnesses are sworn in, and attorneys have subpoena power, can subpoena A&R witnesses who might otherwise want to avoid scrutiny of their decision-making. And then those then get appealed to the court. If you exempt huge areas of jurisdiction. If you shoehorn development into downtowns without that level of review, there's now not a decision to appeal. There's not a formal quasi-judicial hearing process as is now currently provided. And, of course, that's what the developers want to see, and that's part of the quid pro quo that VNRC has worked out with the development community, frankly, and the Scott administration.
Okay, I want to bring in a couple callers here. We have Tim on the line from Rochester. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. So in 1990, it was required to get by some of the Act 250 permitting to get on 10 acres of land. So we've got 10 acres of land. Both of our parents, my wife's parents and my parents, graduated from Rochester High School. We graduated from Rochester High School. And my two kids graduated from high school. So in 1990, when we built the house, since then we have been paying our taxes, keeping the property good. But I cut 7 acres of trees, flattened that out, I put in a pond, and my friggin' driveway is over 4.
Yeah, we lost the signal there, Tim. I'm sorry to say.
No, clarification. I think people continue to get confused. The 10-acre exemption that I believe the caller was alluding to is actually an exemption from the what they call the on-site septic regulations. That if you had a 10 greater than 10-acre lot, you weren't subject at the time to the requirements for constructing a septic system. You could just build it without an engineering plan, et cetera.
Yep.
So. People confuse that with Act 250. It's a different program. His concern appears to be that with this road rule, this 2,000-foot road rule, that somehow he'd be triggered or what have you. He would not have that. It's a pre-existing lot.
Okay. I want to bring in another caller, Stephanie from Callis. Good morning, Stephanie. Okay. I wanted to ask go back to this Stowe case, because, and I don't mean to pick on the town of Stowe, by the way. I hope nobody in Stowe is offended here, but it was just an interesting example here of a couple of issues that I wanted to delve into a little bit with both you, John Brabant, and with you, Brooke Dingledean, my two guests here. And I'll put the question to Brooke. If you have a town, really any town, Stowe or anybody else, put solely in charge of local development, as in exempt from Act 250 because they have their own sort of administrative infrastructure in areas like development control, planning, zoning, and so on. The town, it seems to me, could end up with a bit of a conflict of interest because, let's say, it's a big resort expansion. It's going to generate a lot of tax revenue for the town, big upside there for if you're a municipal official. And it may have impacts regionally on neighboring towns or whatever. If the decisions are left entirely to the municipality, they could go one way based purely on considerations about tax revenue. If they are more regionally considered, they could include things like what happens when your local river flows downstream to the neighboring town, and or what happens when the road that comes into your town off of the interstate exchange, which is in the neighboring town, is suddenly getting a lot more traffic because of this new development in your town, but your consideration didn't really have to, or actually maybe legally couldn't, look at what was happening with the interstate exchange and the traffic around there in the neighboring town. Are those issues that worry you, Brooke Dingledean?
I'm sorry, Dave?
I was asking, in terms of the regional impacts of a local development, if decisions are made, are left to the local level because of the city or town is exempt from Act 250, and says we want to have this big new development in our community, great for tax revenues. That may look like a really nice thing from the perspective of that town, but what about regional impacts? Let's say it generates a lot more traffic on an interstate exchange, basically exits in a neighboring town, or let's say it generates impacts in a river that then flows downstream to neighboring towns.
And I think that was the whole point of a state land use Act 250 law. The whole purpose was we're no longer going to look at each of these bits and pieces in isolation, that our entire environment is connected. And to the extent that regional folks have the ability to say, wait a minute, I mean, you saw this in the wind cases, where the host town got money, the developer would give them, here, we're going to help you with your tax rate, and everyone's going to pay less every year. But what about the people in all of the surrounding communities who were impacted in some cases more than the people in the host town? And they got shut out, they got their views spoiled, and health effects visited upon them. They lost the wildlife in the area. So, yes, the whole point is that Act 250 was supposed to deal with the larger projects that would have the major impacts. Now we're saying the larger projects, if they're in a certain place, we don't care anymore, and we'll figure out some other notion of how to do it. That, I think, is the wrong direction for Act 250 at this point. If there are streamlining issues, fine. We don't want duplicative processes, but that is not what occurs. But let me just shift the focus for a minute, if I can, because earlier on, when we were talking about the political process, I was listening yesterday, and Senator Bray said there were 36 months of their study committees, and legislatures got together. All these people talked and talked. Well, that happened for 2 years. There were study committees. And then what happened this past legislative session is that the whole process was hijacked. And the NRC came in and co-opted and pretended that they had talked with all the environmentalists in the state, and district commissioners were represented, supposedly, and other environmental groups. And they came up with this deal, and it's a compromise, and they pat themselves on the back and tell their donors, see, we've done something good for the environment. So they cherry-pick a couple pieces downtown and forest fragmentation, sound like they'll make a big splash, and someone will get credit for doing something for the environment. And I think that is a false narrative. When the NRC says that they are not a political organization, then I would like to know why they have 19 paid lobbyists who appeared before the legislature in 2019-2020. When I have approached them and tried to discuss my concerns as a practitioner in this area, I'm shut out of the process. And I'm told, we have a deal with the administration, ANR is on board with it, and then I can't get before the legislature to tell them what I think is really important, like how can you eliminate court review? You don't get to do that. And this is why, that violates our constitutional. So the real concern that I have at this moment in time is that this pared-down, cherry-picked version of what they want to put through, which is really to say we made some progress after 36 months of all of these study committees, my concern is that what's being voted on isn't even understood, even though it's a very pared-down version. I have had several conversations with senators where I have said, do you understand that this bill allows Act 250 jurisdiction to disappear on any property in the state, not downtowns, not limited to just downtown areas, if you can check three boxes? That's what this legislation does. And I met with, no, Brooke, you're wrong. This applies only to downtown development. It does not. And I don't know why they think that. Are they not reading the actual bill? I don't think that they are. Or it's very complicated, because you have to understand where the provision is going in the statutes. It's not in the downtown development portion. It's in jurisdiction. So what does that mean? And this is my concern about public participation. You have not had the district commissioners vet this and tell you what this means at the district office and what's going to happen from a practical standpoint. So now that I know that this provision is enacted, I'm going to call every one of my clients, because I am duty-bound to tell them a law just passed that gives you the opportunity to get rid of Act 250 on your property, and we are going to rush the doors, because I can think of a dozen clients that I need to tell them that for this opportunity for their property. And I'm only one of many, many environmental attorneys around the state. They haven't thought this through, and that's what's so frustrating about it, because it's even worse now with COVID and being on these Zoom calls. Yeah, more people can watch. I'm glad you're getting, you know, people that are actually sitting there watching you on TV. But the problem is they don't get to talk to the TV. Nobody will listen to their concerns. And yet they, you know, they say, we don't need any more testimony. We've done this for 36 months. Well, then why does the NRC keep getting hour after hour of testimony time in front of you? And I believe that the agenda of this bill is not for the public good. I think it is an agenda for a private deal. And I think that the environment of Vermont is going to take a hit as a result. And it will bring Act 250 to its knees.
Let me bring in one of our other Vermont environmental attorneys. You mentioned you are one of many, Brooke Dingledean. I believe we have another on the line with us who just called in. Stephanie Kaplan from Callis has been also working in the Act 250 trenches for decades. And good morning, Stephanie. Do you think that the do you think that Brooke is right about this? That this is a deal which is not in the public interest?
Yes, I do agree. I've been sort of on the sidelines watching this. I testified a couple years ago to the House Natural Resources Committee, but as Brooke pointed out, it's basically a different bill than back then, and there really hasn't been enough testimony and scrutiny of what it is that the Senate Natural Resources Committee is now trying to get out of their committee and approved by the full legislature. And I have a couple of points I wanted to make. One was, I listened to the program yesterday with Ed and Chris and John, and I think Chris Bray was asked, you know, what's the urgency here? And he never really answered it, as I recall. He just went on and on about, as Brooke just pointed out, about all the many hearings that they've had and the millions of people who've been involved. And a lot of that, as Brooke pointed out, is just simply not true. So I still would like to know what's the urgency, and the only thing I can think of is what Brooke just said, is that there's a deal made, and they're pushing this deal through, and it's the administration and the VNRC. And I wanted to comment a couple of things about that, too, and that is that, you know, I was the lawyer who represented the citizens group in Stowe. And it was a great example of how, and it's still true, that the Agency of Natural Resources that issues the water quality permits, among other environmental permits, and many municipalities are under, particularly the ANR, under a lot political pressure. I mean, they work for the governor, and so they carry out the governor's policies. And John touched on this, that Act 250, the important thing about Act 250 is that, as John said, it's quasi-judicial, which means it's run kind of like an informal court. That is, the decisions, first of all, there's public participation, which there isn't at the Agency of Natural Resources. So the public can participate. If they have an interest, they become parties. They can present evidence. They can present expert witnesses. They can cross-examine the applicant and the applicant's witnesses. That's entirely missing from the Agency of Natural Resources. Most of their permits are behind-the-scenes deals. So, to me, having had many years of experience with Act 250, as you said, it's extremely important distinction between Act 250 proceedings and anything that goes on at ANR. And municipalities, as I think we all know, have their own agendas, and often, as with the Stowe case, they wanted the Stowe resort to be able to expand because of the tax benefits, et cetera. It's also interesting, having been around for a while, that to see the change in the VNRC, and it really is shocking to me. I mean, I have a box full of permit reform that I worked on. I worked for Act 250 for 8 years when I was general counsel and executive officer. And we were always, we had task forces and we had meetings and we did reports. And during all that time, the developers were always advocating to get rid of what they called the redundancy between Act 250 and ANR and municipalities. And the VNRC was the champion of Act 250. And they were making the same arguments that we're now bringing out here about the importance of Act 250 and the importance of maintaining Act 250 jurisdiction over towns and over the Agency of Natural Resources permits.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, obviously, things changed. But they were just the absolute champions of citizen participation and the importance of Act 250. And it's very, very sad to me to see what's going on with that organization, which no longer is, you know, and they say openly that their role is to balance the environment with the economy. And, you know, they sound like the Chamber of Commerce. We've got plenty of chambers of commerce. We need, you know, we need active, vocal environmental agencies. So that would, you know, and of course the relevance to this bill is the bill would take away jurisdiction in downtown.
Boy, oh boy, Stephanie, I gotta go to another caller here. You raise a lot of interesting issues here, but I want to squeeze in one more call before the top of the hour. This segment once again went by in a blur, and I think we may have to continue our conversation about Act 250 in the near future. Maybe not immediately in the next show, but this is obviously a hot topic. Let's bring in James Ellers. I believe he's on the line now too. James.
Hey Dave, thanks for the opportunity.
Got to be quick because we got about 2 minutes left, James.
Sure, I will be extremely quick. I just want to echo comments of the two previous callers and put an exclamation point on this, if I may. The last people that should be getting Act 250 exemptions are our mayors and city councils of these communities that know they have failing and or inadequate wastewater infrastructure. If the mayor of Montpelier cared about her impact on those downstream, they would not be continuing to seek exemptions from oversight. I say this because in the Lake Champlain Basin alone in 2019, there were some 212 diversions known by the governor, known by the agency, of untreated and partially treated human waste, that's feces and urine, mixed with gutter waste, and many of these watersheds already have bacteria cleanup plans dating back to 2011. There's 22 watersheds that have bacteria that are impaired, polluted by bacteria, that the Agency of Natural Resources knows about. And yet,
all right. Well, James Ellers, I gotta stop you there. I think you bring up, though, a very interesting example of real impacts here that can be subject to Act 250 review, and that's a key issue as these developments are considered. I want to thank you and thank the other callers as well as the guests I had on the program today, John Brabant and Brooke Dingledean. You've all been terrific, and I want to revisit this issue as it continues to percolate along. So thank you very much. Hey, that's going to be about it for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show, and I wish everybody an excellent Independence Day weekend, even though it's going to be a slightly different one from the one we normally have. And stay healthy, everybody. We'll talk to you all on Monday.